This is the fourth day of this January 2013 Rohatsu 7-day session. And we'll resume today reading from the teachings of Chinese Zen Master Zibo. And the book is called Zibo, the Last Great Zen Master of China. And he lived in the 16th century, and this is translated by J.C. Cleary. This is a section that the translator calls The Value of Adversity. And Zibo tells us, "The workings of mind have no constancy. Controlling them is up to the person." Let's just pause there. There's nothing so inconstant as the mind. It really is constantly manifesting the truth of impermanence. It's constantly in flux. That is its constancy. Flux. Change. What we can bring to that is just where we choose to direct our attention without getting swept up in all of the workings of the mind. He says, if you control mind with the power of the path, the way, the Tao, you do not pay attention to success and profit. If you control mind by means of success and profit, you do not pay attention to humanity and righteousness. There's a famous Zen saying that says pretty much the same thing. When worldly thoughts are intense, thoughts of the way are weak. When thoughts of the way are intense, worldly thoughts are weak. You can't have it both ways. If you're consumed by thoughts of success and profit, then there isn't the bandwidth to be really dedicated to the Dharma. And then he goes on, referring to success and profit on the one hand, and humanity and righteousness on the other. He says, tracing back what they start from, though they proceed differently, neither the power of the path nor success and profit is beyond one's own mind. The divergence is in what the will is placed on. So it's all a matter of mind. And what determines our progress, if you will, on the path is where we direct our attention. My favorite sayings is by the Spanish philosopher and writer José Ortega y Gasset, who said, "Tell me to what you pay attention, and I'll tell you who you are." That where we place our attention determines who we are. And that's where Zen comes in. Because it teaches that, if nothing else, is how to direct our attention and how where not to put our attention on. Of course, if you Zeebo here may be speaking mostly to his monks, and if you're a householder, if you have work and family and so forth, of course you have to devote some attention to those things. But how much in comparison to Mu, or in comparison to just being fully present with what is, rather than scheming and planning and strategizing about how to be more successful or wealthier. He goes on, when the power of the way controls the mind, everything is a stepping stone, even being robbed and mistreated. When success and profit control the mind, everything is a cause for alarm, even glory and honor. When causes of alarm disturb the mind, the spirit is always troubled, all the more so when one is robbed or mistreated. Thus a person on the path considers it the best luck to be in unwished for situations. If one does not awaken amidst this great good luck, but rather floats along pursuing objects, this is called dimming the mind. A person whose mind is dimmed, even if in daily contact with sages and saints, is no different from a blind man who thinks it's the dead of night, even though the bright sun is above his head. Well, this statement, a person on the path considers it the best luck to be in unwished for situations, it's kind of a stretch. I don't know how many would want misfortune. But his point is that, of course, is that when misfortune befalls us, when we get into trouble, when we are mistreated or taken advantage of, or such times we can use those things, which goes back to the little title of this segment, The Value of Adversity, or what Shakespeare would say, sweet are the uses of adversity. So times of loss, losing someone close to you through death, times of sickness, of injury, this is where the rubber hits the road for people who are practicing Zen. How do you respond? How do you manage difficult circumstances? Well, we get training in this in Sesshin. How do you manage it when things that were going along so smoothly suddenly go south? Your mind is a riot of thoughts and self-concerns, and time is dragging, and you have pain in your legs, and everything's going wrong. How do you manage that? That's where, of course, the practice comes in, the particular practice we're working on. It's not complicated. You don't have to have a checklist at such times. You don't need a complicated strategy. You just go to the practice, the breath, the koan, shikantaza, whatever you're doing. That's it. That's the whole thing. Yeah, in the case of physical pain, yes, there's a place for just taking whatever measures you need to in the way of cushions or posture or whatever. But aside from that, mostly that's not the issue. Mostly it's just the mind. And our work at such times, our work at managing how we direct our attention, that determines how we deal with adversity generally outside Sesshin. Sesshin is like a laboratory. Everything is right here this week. But it's framed in a structure and in conditions that enable us to really devote ourselves to applying the mind, learning how to apply the mind so that we're not bound by misfortune and adversity. And then from time to time we may find ourselves in our life outside Sesshin tested. Okay, what mental resources did we develop in Sesshin? It's going to be on full display when we meet up with some real serious challenge outside Sesshin. Where he says, if one does not awaken amidst this great good luck, the good luck meaning being able to have found the path and to be able to work with others, the support of others, with a teacher in these perfect conditions, if one doesn't, but rather floats along pursuing objects. He's talking, of course, about mental objects in these conditions, these circumstances that are tailor-made for developing our spiritual resources to then just while away the hours and the days daydreaming, pursuing objects of the mind. This, he says, is called dimming the mind. He goes on, generally, if you just don't deceive mind, mind of itself is luminous and wise. If you just don't deceive mind, if you don't involve yourself in thoughts, using the luminous and wise mind, when you are placed in unwished for situations, they are like remnants of snow naturally melting away in spring. It doesn't take crashing thunder splitting the earth open to disperse them. The Book of Poetry, that's a title of a particular book, the Book of Poetry says, the stone of another mountain can be used to cut jade. If you use jade to cut jade, forming a vessel is exceedingly difficult because both are smooth and rubbing them together has no effect. Thus, when you are placed in a desirable situation, mind and situation are both forgotten. Since you forget, you lose awareness. Thus it is said, adverse situations are a spear in your face, favorable situations are an arrow in the back of your head. And then he says, the spear in your face is easy to dodge. The arrow in the back of your head is hard to defend against. if we can take one thing away from this segment, it's to be aware, to be vigilant, and not let ourselves become complacent and just ride along on the surface of things when things are going well, when things are easy. And we get a chance to test ourselves during Sesshin with that too. It's not just the difficult times, it's when things are flowing, then one person will just float along and become lax and enjoy the relative ease, whereas another person will use it, take advantage of the lack of obstacles, lack of adversity, to step it up. Most of us, I suppose, maybe all of us, when we're less experienced at all of this, we do just naturally float along when things are going well. But then when we've gone through enough cycles of adversity and smoothness, then we start to figure out that those smooth periods, those flowing periods, are conditioned. They're conditioned phenomena, and they will change, and we can't rely on them. Mostly this business is not something we have to remember. We don't have to remember it because when we're going through it, we're learning directly what works and what doesn't work. And we see the consequences of, on the one hand, floating along with things when they're going well, and on the other hand, maintaining our exertions when things are going well. And then we experience it directly. This is the Zen school, the school of direct experience. Here's quite a different topic, adaptable compassion. Generally, people pay back their deceased parents' virtue by making offerings of food on prescribed occasions. But they are only increasing their karma. Worldly conventional people are benighted and blind. It is always hard to explain the true principle to them. So, Zibo, being Chinese, is referring to filial piety. After one's parents die, at certain intervals, you make offerings at the family shrine or the local temple. But then what does he mean? They're only increasing their karma. He explains, temporarily going along with their customs and practices to make them happy, the sage worthies realize that their habits are not easily changed. Provisionally floating and sinking along with them, the sages use inner truth to cut away their sentiments, working in the shadows, secretly taming and tempering them. After long effort, the power is sufficient and their habits change by themselves. So he really is talking here about skillful means. Knowing when to accommodate people in their habits so that you can maintain a relationship with them. Roshi Kaplan used to say, sometimes you have to give people what they want in order for them to want what you have to give them. This isn't just the job of a teacher. Anyone can do this with people they know, family, people at work. Accommodating. This is one of the key virtues or skills, rather. This is one of the key skills that we develop through practice. I remember in the 1970s when most of us were brand new or relatively new at the center, Roshi would let us put up a Christmas tree at the Zen Center at Christmas. It's a way of, there's this saying I heard once, the wise missionary lets the natives keep their idols under the bed, hidden under the bed. I think we all grew that. We don't need to make such a big fuss about Christmas anymore. And we've accommodated in our schedule to the holidays, our own Native American holidays, Thanksgiving. This is one of our two biggest weekends of the year. We use that as our own way of practice. After long effort, the power is sufficient and their habits change by themselves. Those who are undergoing the tempering are oblivious to why it is so. Thus, the sages share the vicissitudes of social forms. If they didn't rejoice at what the conventional people celebrate, if they didn't offer condolences when the conventional people mourn, this would mean bitter feelings against the sages. It's interesting that he uses this example of joining with people in rituals when they mourn, because this is not something that has ever been abandoned that I know of in Buddhist practice in East or West. This has become a huge part of Zen practice in Japan, is doing memorial services and funerals. In fact, it is the primary practice. I read a book a few years ago by an American woman who had been a Zen priest in Japan for 20 years or something like that. And the book is all about the way things are in Japan, is in Zen, the way Zen works in Japan at most temples and monasteries. And I was shocked to see that at most Zen temples in Japan today, no sitting is done. Their main activity is doing memorial services and funerals, because these are lucrative. They help support the temple, maintain things, and provide the funds for repair and maintenance and so forth. But this just blew my mind. No sitting done at Zen temples. No wonder there were two Roshis in Japan when I was there who said Zen is dying in Japan and being reborn in America. At those temples, there was plenty of sitting. next segment. Before joy and anger take shape, inherent nature is originally complete. Once joy and anger have taken shape, if what is generated does not go wrong and does not go against what's there before it's generated, this is called harmony. If there is the slightest inclination to bias, this is called disharmony. When habitual practices are deep-rooted, they are hard to remold, even with heaven and earth as the furnace, yin and yang as the fuel, a whirlwind for a bellows, and the Creator's power. Creator's power, this is the translator's rendering. We don't have a creator in Buddhism. But the point of how deep-rooted these habit forces are in us. Thus the Buddha used the water of emptiness to wash them away. So what he means by this, he didn't have to use it. We all have emptiness. We all are emptiness. He taught us methods. The primary method is what we're doing, methods by which to realize the empty nature, the insubstantial nature of reality, of ourselves and others. And it is this that liberates us from the force of habit, blind habit, blind passions. Once we have directly experienced this core teaching of emptiness, not just figured it out in our minds and gotten it intellectually, but have confirmed it through our direct experience, then everything is changed. Then we see that even our most deeply ingrained habits have no roots to them. They are of no substance. And that is enormously confirming as to our ability to change. If there is no self, then we're not stuck with the self. There's no self we're stuck with, and then there can't be any habits that are absolutely fixed. We can work on ourselves, with ourselves, with these habits. We work on these habits, not thinking about them again, but through the simple direct practice, then they yield, our habits yield to insight. What could be more promising, more wonderful, that there is nothing that we're stuck with? Little do people realize that before anger and joy arise, they are the same as the Buddhas and ancestral teachers. If they go wrong with anger, they become asuras. Now he's listing the what are called the six realms of unenlightened existence. Asuras means fighting demons, usually translated as fighting demons, people who are bound by power, winning or losing. That's their world. Is, you know, if you don't have power over someone, then someone has power over you, and you have to win, and you can't lose. And that's sort of a very simple modern explanation of the asura realm. So, if they go wrong with anger, they become asuras. If they go wrong with ignorance, they become animals. If they go wrong with greed, they become hungry ghosts. If they go wrong with evil, they become hell beings. Devas and humans, those are the fifth and sixth of these six realms, are so by means of the 10 virtues and the 5 precepts. These are the so-called 6 paths. Nevertheless, a deva, that's someone living a very privileged, fortunate life, a deva who does not awaken can become a human. A human who does not awaken can become an animal. With such a multitude of faults, it would be impossible for them to return to their true state without using the water of emptiness to wash them away. Moreover, there are 3 kinds of not awakening: confusion due to views and thoughts, confusion due to the multiplicity of sense objects, and fundamental ignorance. All with blood and breath are guilty of these 3. That's why they do not attain to the path of the sages. They do not penetrate to inner truth. They do not fuse phenomena, and they do not get the subtle wonder of the path. This phrase, they do not fuse phenomena, I would take this to mean they do not see that all things are indivisible. They do not reach a samadhi. If they penetrated inner truth, they would comprehend wherever they go. With fusion, no phenomena could obstruct them. With subtle wonder, they could encompass emptiness and existence without getting entangled. In this way, ready-made subtle function would be complete in each and every one. It's an interesting way to divide 3 kinds of obstructions: the ones that are due to views and thoughts, the ones that are due to attachment to sense objects, and then fundamental ignorance. And then he says, all with blood and breath are guilty of these 3. Fundamental ignorance means not knowing the nature of things. And it is this fundamental ignorance that gives rise to the 3 poisons: greed, anger, and delusion. But it all comes from not knowing the nature of things. And that's where Kensho comes in. Kensho literally means seeing the nature of things, seeing that things are no thing. Seeing things as indivisible, that no thing is apart from any other thing. We people today have a tremendous accumulation of good and evil. The mountain of self and others is high. When things go against us, we are angered and displeased. When joy and anger are born, the substratum of luminous awareness is obscured. Once this pedestal of awareness is obscured, when we see form, we are deluded by form, and when we hear sounds, we are deluded by sounds. Just a word about this. He's mentioned several times joy, and I think most people would think, well, what's wrong with joy? Give me a break. Joy is joy. Who wouldn't want that? But he's talking about a kind of uncentered joy that's based on changing conditions. So we win the lottery, there's joy. Now what? Then, according to what I've always heard, then your life is ruined after that. So joy, in this sense, is something that just can pitch us around every which way and leave us just lost when we become attached to joy, joyful circumstances or conditions. Of course, from occasions when there's it's natural to feel joy, the birth of a child or grandchild or anything that is part of normal human sentiment, of course we're going to feel joy. We don't have a choice in it. That's how we're wired. We're going to feel joy, but he's warning about not getting attached to these states because they're states. They're just states. Joy passes. Anger passes. Fear passes. Anxiety passes. Sorrow passes. Desire passes. We learn this directly in Zazen, and especially in Sesshin. We see how these states arise. They come and they go. And that's how we learn not to be attached to any particular state. And that's what gives rise eventually to equanimity, evenness, this wonderful, quiet evenness. Where we're not being whipsawed between joy and sorrow and fortune and misfortune. I know that there are people who are not convinced that that's what they want. They don't want the negative stuff, but they don't want to lose the good stuff. But it's a package deal. You can't. You want one, you've got them both. Both sides of this. And that actually is a test of people in practice, whether the suffering that comes from attachment to positive states, whether that is worth the suffering. Excuse me. Yeah, you know what I mean. this mountain of self and others, in Mumon, in the Mumon Khan, in a verse in the Mumon Khan, he refers to this 1,000 myriad piled mountain. Karma, conditioning, habit forces. He goes on, fragrant and foul, sweet and bitter, rough and smooth, the shadows of likes and dislikes, these are all forms of knowledge generated from sense objects. Since the knowledge is deluded, it goes wrong. Going wrong, it moves away from reality. He's talking about the normal kind of processing of the world by ordinary people. He'll explain more. The one round light is fragmented into the six consciousnesses. Once it becomes discriminating consciousness, it judges the body to be the self. Deluded by sexual attraction, increased by desires for food and drink, the waves of sentiment flood out, washing you along into impermanence. This creates all sorts of evil manifestations in the skull's cave of false imaginations. The sky cannot cover them, the earth cannot bear them up. Tied up in the dark for eternal ages, changing physical shape, rising and sinking through myriad forms. The bitter suffering is indescribable. If people are bitten by mosquitoes, they squirm around and are not at peace. If they hear of this suffering and their minds remain unmoved, can they be called the most luminous of beings? So many of the masters have issued these stark warnings about the consequences of our attachment to things, sense, objects, pleasures. Most of us don't haven't confirmed this through experience. Let's call it attachment to the body and its pleasures. And so it's always, I think for most people, it rings a little hollow. It's not all that convincing. But it becomes more so once we suffer the consequences of the body as it deals with afflictions of one kind or another, injury, illness, so forth. Come to a stopping point here, so we'll stop and recite the four vows.